Welcome to Special Sauce, Sirius XM's podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
We have a television show which just launched, public television. We have a weekly public radio show that's an hour. It's a podcast as well, of course. We have the magazine, the cookbook. We do events. We have a cooking school 3 nights a week. We have, obviously, the newsstand part of our business, social media.
My guest this week is, how do I adequately describe you, Chris? Author, cook, something, Chris Kimball. That's it.
Well, didn't you say pain in the ass last time
we
spoke?
Pain in the ass. Yeah. I think it was pain in the ass.
Yeah, I think that was it.
Anyway, good to have you back, Chris.
Pleasure.
I would say, and I hope I'm not delving into waters, that there was a fair amount of drama surrounding your departure from Cook's Illustrated.
What, you think?
At America's Test Kitchen in a very public way. What can you tell us about that? I know there's legal stuff, so...
Not much. I would just say I would say that, forgetting about why all that happened, the upshot was for me, looking back 2 years later, was wonderful. I mean, I got to focus on how I really cook now. I got to rethink how I cook.
It was wonderful what you got to.
Yeah.
But not the process of getting there.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other story, I guess. no, you know what it is? I have a touchy-feely yoga friend who always has these great euphemisms. And she always said, you know, when you need it the most, the universe shows up to help. And so we just had a lot of people come out of the woodwork to help us, and things fell in place. And now I'm doing something I really love with a new group of people, and I get to do exactly what I want. I think as a business grows and you have lots of employees, it's hard, and I'm a terrible corporate CEO in terms of managing a process, you know,
right.
the org chart. Someone actually did an org chart at Most Realized Week. I said, if you ever show that to anybody, I'm going to fire you. Like, get this out of here. I mean, I like to be involved with the details. I like to sit down and talk about the design of the magazine. I like to sit down and talk about the radio show or the TV show. I like to be involved in the creative process. I'm really not good at sitting in a meeting and having those people take a meeting and those people take a meeting, and eventually something else happens. And so I'm really not the person you'd want to run a big organization.
And
it's not me.
And so... is it because the organization got too big that you took an investor that wanted you to go places that you were not comfortable going in? Like, what was the precipitating?
Obviously, I'm not going to answer that question. But I can say that, let's say there was a difference of opinion about what the future should look like at that company. And I really believe in brands. In that a brand, we're in the world in the 21st century. You know, let's go back. Back in the 20s, they invented modern advertising and PR. They figured out that when you sell a product, you're selling the psychological satisfaction of owning the product, not just the product, right? Over time, that became more and more sophisticated, like Mad Men, right? Well, we now live in an era where it's about the brand. A brand is breathing and living and has a personality, and people have to feel good about the brand and want to participate in your brand, and you have to believe in your brand, and you have to bring the brand to life. And if you're not fully invested in your brand, people know it. Consumers are very smart. And so I really believe that to be successful in this highly competitive world, you really need to first and foremost think about your brand and your voice and your personality as a company. And if everyone isn't pulling the same oar in the same direction, mm-hmm. I don't think you'll be successful more. I think you really have to think about business that way. On one hand, there's data-driven decision-making and spreadsheets and all this stuff, which is useful. I mean, you got to be able to do that. But the most important thing is to know who you are, what you represent, how you communicate with your customer, and you have to relate to them and they have to relate to you. If you don't get that part right, you have nothing. And so I'm a big believer in always starting every conversation from that perspective.
That's got really... it. Okay. So you started Milk Street. And how is it different from all the other ventures? God knows you've started enough successful ventures.
Well, it's totally different in that I wasn't asking people what they wanted and giving it to them. There's a wonderful story when Cy Newhouse bought The New Yorker, and a guy called Steve Florio was the publisher. I don't know if you ever
met him. Yes, he's a legendary publisher, larger than life.
He was physically and personality-wise larger than life. I've met him a few times. He was at the Four Seasons in the grill room having lunch with Bill Shawn. And he called Mr. Newhouse over. This is the story anyway. And he said, Mr. Shawn, how do you decide what your readers want? And William Shawn said, well, I don't. I put what I'm interested in The New Yorker. And I, you know, and then my readers, I'm there on behalf of my readers, but I never ask them what they want. I do what I want, what I'm interested in. And so I've spent my whole life before this essentially asking people what they want and giving it to them. I'm doing the opposite now. I'm not asking them what they want.
So you're actually reverse engineering the Chris Kimball
way. I'm going totally against that fundamental precept, which is give people what they want. I think that we're right at the moment where people are rethinking and want to rethink how they cook at home. I think there are much better ways to cook at home than we have cooked here for a couple hundred years. And I think people are open to being given ideas and techniques and recipes that they've never made before. So now I'm going out on a limb and saying, look, you know what? I've been around a long time. I have a pretty good idea how people cook at home, what they're willing to do and what they're not willing to do. But you know what? You've never cooked with sumac before. Okay, we're going to do a recipe with sumac, you know, and trust me, it's going to be worth it, and you can go find it in your supermarket. So I really want to be ahead of my customer a little bit now instead of being a half step behind. I want to be a little bit ahead. It's riskier, but it's a lot more fun.
Right. It's more forward thinking, and you're sort of leading, but where people already are, you think. You hope.
Yeah. I mean, look, I didn't invent this stuff. I mean, there's been a ton of people out there been doing this a long time. All I'm doing is a little bit of what Julia did in a way. I'm a translator saying, look, we'll go look at all this stuff and we'll bring back that portion of it, which I think makes sense here, and then we'll put it together in a form that makes you comfortable with it. So, you know, there's a million people like Fuchsia Dunlop, Every Grain of Rice, for example. Well, if you really want to know something about Sichuan
cooking.
We
love Fuchsia Dunlop.
Fuchsia Dunlop's brilliant, you know. And so I'm not going to know more about that kind of cooking that she does, but my job is to go figure out, okay, well, this kind of works, that works. Let's figure out how to put this together in a menu for people where they can consume it and it makes sense for them. So it's exciting because I'm doing something I've never done before, and my cooking's totally changed. I mean, in the last 5 years, I don't cook at all the same way that I used to. I mean, everything has changed.
Because I do think of the cooking at Cooks Illustrated and America's Test Kitchen as very Americana-driven,
yeah,
and you call it Northern European-derived. But as you say, you're not the first person to say, oh, yeah, I had something great to eat in Chiang Mai. How can I do it here?
No, but I think that you have to pick your timing. I mean, right. I mean, if you think about what's happened in the last 5 or 10 years, I was in Lancaster, Pennsylvania last fall visiting one of my kids at college. And I had lunch at the Tibetan Grill. And the food was great, you know. And then I was in Madison, Wisconsin and had lunch at the Himalayan Grill. You know, I mean, the fact of the matter is people are much more sophisticated about food. The TV shows have changed. The Internet's changed everything.
The food network's changed.
And so the fact of the matter is people want different flavors. They want big flavors. They want contrasting flavors. They want something new. And guess what? Many places in the world cook in a way that makes more sense for us today than the way we have been doing it. I mean, that's really the thing. If you think about Thai cooking, it's all about the prep. You prep it and then it cooks in 5 minutes, right? I mean, a lot of things do. I mean, look, handfuls of herbs, chili, spices. I mean, how many spices were there in Northern Europe? If you look at French cooking, go through the mastering of the French cooking and see how many spices there are. You know, four. I mean, they don't use spices, really.
Half
a dozen. Ottoman Empire at 88.
Right.
Handfuls of herbs, chilies, fermented sauces, you know, ginger, galangal, lemongrass, fish sauce. I mean, all of these big flavors. And when you're starting with a palate of really big flavors, you can get something that has big flavor pretty easily because you're not dealing with a ton of technique. You're not dealing with a lot of time. You know, French cooking starts with relatively mild ingredients that have to be very high quality, and then you have to work with them in a way to coax out flavor just the right way. It's a process that requires skill. And besides which, if you take a supermarket chicken that's 6 weeks old and try to make coq au vin, you know, you're in trouble. So, yeah, that's exciting because there are more interesting solutions to the problem, what's for dinner.
What you've hit upon is something that's simultaneously reductive and expansive, you know, in terms of, you know.
Can I steal that? That was really good.
Yeah. You
reductive and expansive.
Yeah.
That was good.
I think it's true because you've always been about reduction, right? You've always said, look, let's face it. There's, you know, people want to know how to cook 25 things
right.
super well.
Right.
This sort of, as you've said, this is not about that. It's recognizing the way people's palates and interests have expanded and trying to
yes.
reduce the tension that occurs when they try to incorporate that into their home cooking.
If you look around the world and look at all the choices, you go crazy. Because you'd have to buy hundreds of cookbooks and then figure out which four recipes in each book will be best adapted to the way you want to cook. The fact of the matter is that it is valuable to have someone actually go around the world and go through that process and help you figure out what will make sense. I mean, you know, we're not about authentic. You know, I'm not interested in accurately reproducing a recipe from
Senegal.
So that's
not – that's where you diverge
yeah.
from Fuchsia Dunlop, for example.
Yeah. Well, even Fuchsia Dunlop, if you look at Every Grain of Rice or The Land of Fish and Rice, her latest book.
Yeah, there's interpretive stuff.
She's I think she's done a very good job of interpreting it and bringing it to the American or mm-hmm. the European
yeah,
audience.
I agree.
She's not just doing, you know. So someone told me a long time ago, it was interesting. They said that when they were growing up, they got these quote unquote ethnic cookbooks, a term I don't like very much. And they were all these complicated recipes, you know, these Saturday night recipes. And they said, well that's not how I cooked. You know, we cooked every day in a much simpler way. So it's the simple everyday stuff. If I'm going to travel, I don't want to go to the fancy restaurant. I want to go to someone's house and put together, you know, some simple soup. You know, that's where I want to be.
To me, when I read the book and when I look at what you're doing at Milk Street, there's sort of a more direct emotional and political slant. The political may be more in subtext.
Well, it was Naomi Duguid who said it to me in an interview 6 months ago, and I really respect her. And she actually got teary-eyed.
Great cookbook writer.
Yeah. Sweet, sour, salty,
yeah,
bitter,
yeah.
and initial with her husband at the time. And she started almost crying. She said, you know, this is – it's a bit, the world's a big place, but everyone's going to sit down at the same table, right? And I thought that was the perfect – it was her vision, really – everyone sits down at the same table. It's not like there's this group over here and this ethnic cuisine over there. We're all cooks, and we're all just trying to get dinner on the table or lunch or whatever, and we can have that conversation. And yeah, I don't know if political is the right word, but it is emotional for me because if you go to some other country and you talk to somebody else who cooks, you immediately have a bond with that person. And it's an amazing thing to be in someone else's kitchen in another country. And I think that – and it's like a radio show about food, but you can't cook on radio. But food is the portal through which you can discuss anything.
Right.
Right. I mean, I was
talking – that's what this show is based on.
Yeah, right. I mean, I was talking to a guy who's a Syrian refugee, and it was this great conversation. Someone had asked him, said, well, can I buy you a cup of tea? I was interviewing Ari Shapiro, actually, from NPR.
Oh, I heard
yeah.
that.
And
I was on the vineyard.
And the guy got mad, and he said, well, no, I can't afford a cup of tea. I used to design hotels in Dubai, you know? And so, yeah, food lets you do that. So there is – I think this is important. It has changed my life in cooking, and I think there really is something there, yeah.
Milk Street has a lot of components, right, as all your previous ventures have.
Yeah, I'm a believer in having, you know, Martha Stewart probably more than anybody invented this.
Multi-platforms.
Yeah, she's very smart. And, we have a weekly television show which just launched, public television. We have a weekly public radio show that's an hour, and it's a podcast as well, of course. We have the magazine, the cookbook, Milk Street Cookbook just came out from Little Brown. We have we do events. You know, I go out in the fall and do stage events in 9 or 10 cities. We have a cooking school 3 nights a week at 177 Milk Street in Boston. Some of it's nonprofit work. Some of it's for money. We have obviously the newsstand part of our business, social media, the website itself. So we have a lot of bits and pieces of that. We will actually have an online store going up in October, mostly to provide some of the ingredients that we talk about in the magazine, spices, that kind of thing. So, yeah, we have all of those. And I think, you know, I was once at a conference. Actually, it was this also at the New York Times. And there was a guy there from Major League Baseball. It was me, a guy from Major League Baseball, and a Wall Street Journal guy. It was about the digital world. And the baseball guy said, you know, my job is to be there. Every time someone turns around and they want information about Major League Baseball, I have to be there. And I thought, well, okay, there's some truth to that. You have to be there in all those places for people. And ultimately, of course, it's just kind of fun to be there, but you do want to be there.
So, and this is the first venture you've launched in the digital age. So you have to be mindful, and you're obviously using many digital tools and tactics.
Sure.
To communicate.
Well, actually, yeah. When I was launching the magazine a year ago, I don't think I've heard there was such a thing as Facebook advertising, but I didn't really know how it worked. And I got an old friend of mine to help out. And now we built the entire – we have about 150,000 circulation. We built the entire circulation off Facebook.
Yeah.
And I still don't fully understand it, but yes, that's a really hugely important part of our business.
Yeah, and of course, what's interesting about that, you can utilize Facebook, but in the end, if you're trying to compete with them from an advertising perspective,
right,
it's rather problematic. That's all I'll say.
Well, we don't take advertising. So.
Right, exactly.
Thankfully.
See, you're so much smarter than I am. You know, one of the things I realize that we have in common that I have to ask you about is Kenji Lopez-Alt.
Yeah.
Kenji worked for you for a long time.
He did.
And then he worked for me and still does. Are you surprised at sort of the crazy way he connected with millennial cooks?
Kenji, it goes back to my comments about brands. Kenji is authentic. You know, he has a science background. He actually, I remember at America's Test Kitchen, he's the guy who would build the smoker out of the kettle grill and back and make, you know, half an ounce of liquid smoke over 24 hours just because he could. And so he is that person he says he is. And I think the Food Lab, I think he managed to create a book where he had a voice, has a voice that's very genuine. And I think it's personal, and I think he was able to combine science and recipes and food in a way.
In a very human way.
That's exactly right. You know, it wasn't just here's the science and the amino acids and, you know, the calcium and chloride ions and what happens. He was able to put that in a context that was very personal. And so you really felt there was a voice there. And you know, he's on our show as a contributor once in a while. And he's, you know, if you listen to his voice, you just get a sense of confidence. And then he says, well, yeah, I tested that, and here's what I did. And, you know, he's done his homework.
Yes.
He's done his homework.
He's an obsessive. You shared that.
Where he's obsessive, but he's also colloquial.
Mm-hmm.
He's able to
yes,
do both.
I describe him as Mr. Wizard meets the Simpsons. You know, because—
Which Simpson?
Well, that's a whole other question. That's a longer
Bart.
Conversation.
Yeah.
So— It's time for the special sauce all-you-can-answer buffet, but before that, I decided with you I'm going to try something new, which is I'm going to take a page out of Reddit. What question do you want to ask me? You're sort of familiar with what we've done at Serious Eats. Like, this is an ask-me-anything moment.
Yeah, I do. Here's my question. The world has gone from thoughtful writing and consideration. Think about the old gourmet or think of the old books or How to Cook a Wolf or whatever. And now we're in the place we are today. Do you think that core of interested people who really want thoughtful writing and discussion about food, do you think that's still there? It's just that it's being swamped a little bit by everything else going on? Or do you think that in 10 or 20 years that just will not be there?
I think it has to be there because that's the only thing I know how to do.
That's my answer too.
Right? It's really I wish I could be somebody who, you know, accepted facile, mediocre work because it was told in an engaging way. But unfortunately, that's not in my DNA. So I hope that the answer to your question is yes. Are we being swamped by everything that you talked about? Absolutely. But as long as I'm involved with Serious Eats, it's going to be about substance. It's great storytelling, rigorously tested recipes, and really good writing, and features that aren't even about cooking that relate to the food culture at large. You know, and God help us if there isn't room for Serious Eats and Milk Street, for that matter. I guess I could only give an answer is I desperately hope the answer is yes.
That was an I hope so answer.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know what gives me – I agree with you, and I think it will be there. I think if you do good work, there'll be enough people to come out to support it. But if you look at the podcasts, go to iTunes, and even look in the food category, the arts category, and look at some of the top – you know, once in a while, just for the heck of it, I listen to some of those podcasts, and you just go, why is this podcast getting hundreds of thousands of downloads a month? And sometimes I can understand, but sometimes I can't.
Yeah.
And all I can say is, well, maybe 2 years from now, they won't be getting
That's right.
Because you have to go for the long – I mean, you and I are both playing the long game, which is we're going to be here a long time from now, and we'll just keep doing our best work. But it is sometimes disheartening when you see things getting a tremendous amount of play that are not – It's just not thoughtful work, and that's, you know, I sound like some horrible third grade French teacher.
I know,
and it's really annoying.
I always say that too. It's like, why do I sound like a curmudgeonly
some whiny old
guy?
Well, we are whiny old guys.
You know, because Elvis Costello once said, "Why are you still angry?" And he said, "I'm getting older, and when you get older, you don't get more reasonable, you get less reasonable."
Right. You have less time, so you have to cram it into fewer years.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, okay, fair.
So who's at your – and I'm really curious about your answer here. Who's at your Last Supper, no family allowed? I just want four people that you'd love to sit down with.
John le Carré. I think he's one of the best writers of the 20th century.
You're the first person that's ever said that, and I couldn't agree with you more.
He's also – I just heard him on Fresh Air recently. He's one of the most thoughtful person about the state of the world. He understands – and his novels, I think, show this. He understands how the world works in a very unique way. He's just an amazing
guy.
Yes,
he is an extraordinary thinker.
He's really amazing.
All right. I like that. Keep going.
You have to keep going.
Yeah.
Dead or they have to be?
Yeah, no, dead.
I would actually love, oddly, this is an easy one, but I would love to have Rosa Lewis.
Rosa Lewis.
You know, remember the Duchess of Duke Street, the 70s BBC, and she was a real person who, actually her hotel was on German Street in London, and she was a scullery maid who ended up being a consort of Edward VI, I think, or 7th, whatever. And she rose to the top of the cooking world in London pre-World War I. And her story is just an amazing story. And then she ended up – World War I, of course, destroyed that whole world because everyone was dead and poor after that. And her going from a scullery maid to a top chef and being in the top echelons of society always just really fascinated me. I thought that was really great.
All right. That's great. Rose, this is really interesting. So we've got two Brits. Mm-hmm. Le Carré and Rosa Lewis?
I suppose that's true, yeah. I would love – I know this is completely lame, but
– We accept lame
answers. I still love Lincoln. I'm sorry. I just think he's – you know, the second inaugural is one of the most beautiful pieces of writing ever. I love his stories. One of his great stories was there was a couple engineers in a town, I guess somewhere – and the supervisor said to the guy, look, when you write reports, they're much too long, because please keep it short. And then there was a huge flood, and the guy wrote his report. He said, where the town was, it ain't now. So, I mean, he used to go around on these circuits, you know, and stay in these boarding houses, and they tell stories and jokes all night. And I think he was just an amazing, you know, and the Gettysburg Address was 3 minutes long. And there's actually a recording I heard of an interview in the 1920s with someone who was there.
Wow.
And the person before him was a governor or somebody, spoke for 2 hours. Lincoln had a high voice, and he stood up, and no one heard a word.
Wow.
It lasted 3 minutes, and no one could hear a word. But I think he would be just fascinating.
So it's a combination of brevity and wisdom.
And a curiosity and a sense of humor, which I think, unfortunately, our great leaders, many of them have sort of lost.
All right. I love this. I love this table. And one more person, you're a deadhead, or you were, like me. You're a lapsed deadhead.
Well, I was.
Like, they're a lapsed Catholic.
I was saving.
They're a lapsed deadhead.
Saving my last, the best for last.
Right.
It would be Jerry Garcia.
It would be Jerry Garcia.
Yeah. I started going to the Fillmore East concerts in February 1970.
Me too. You went to the Midnight to Dawn with the Grateful Dead?
February 10th, yes. And I remember when they do an acoustic set for an hour, right, with Bob and Jerry, which was terrific. And I spent a lot of time going to Dead concerts, and I'm still a deadhead. He was a great musician. He had old-timey, he had jazz, he had rock and roll, he blues, he put a lot of stuff together, bluegrass. But he had a way of connecting. I remember there was one at the Fillmore East in 72 or 3. He asked the house light to be turned up, and he played to the audience for about 15 or 20 minutes. He just played.
Wow.
And he'd look at people. Of course, I thought he looked at me, you know, which, of course, is ridiculous.
But that was his genius.
That was his genius. He could look at everybody at the same time. He was a Buddha. There was something about that. And it wasn't just I was a Columbia student. It was probably under the influence. But his music was transcendent. He had some way. And some of the old-timey stuff he did, the simple songs, were also wonderful. And I played some old-timey stuff, and he was amazing.
To me, it was always with him, his playing, it was a combination of his ferocious intellectual curiosity and the way he connected, the resonance.
Well, he would, I hate the word narrative, because anyone says the word narrative, you probably dope slap them too. So I won't say narrative, but he could tell a story. He understood the music, playing lead guitar, was about telling a story.
Absolutely, like the greatest, like Charlie Parker and John Coltrane.
And you listen to a lot of guys get up there, and they're just doing scales up and down. And the other thing, they're playing licks. He never played licks. He played a song and a melody, and he told a story. And so, for example, Peggy O, which is an old-timey song. There's a great recording of him in New Haven playing that. And listen to his lead on that. It's just amazing. I mean, it was a very sad song. And he just played, he told the story of Peggy O when she played it. And I think most people, guitarists, miss that. It's very hard to do. And
I agree. And it's what separates great players from artists.
I mean, I play and I get up and, I basically play scales, And once in a while, I kind of figure out how to kind of get around the melody. And if there's a chord that's not in the key, I kind of figure that out. But, it's just you might as well just go take your guitar and smash it because you're never going to be able to play like that.
It's true. So what are you eating? What are you all eating? Lincoln, Rosa Lewis, Jerry Garcia.
Well, Jacques Pepin had the great answer. Someone asked if this was your last meal before being executed, and he said, whatever meal would take the longest to cook and eat. So I thought that was a three-day feast.
Kulubiak.
Yes, Kulubiak. Yes, it takes a long time for that brioche. I think that it would be very simple. I think it would be a lot of mezze. I like to eat that way. You start off with a lot of vegetables, and then you move into some fish and a little bit of meat, something very simple. The wine is obviously crucial to that. It's where you're sitting. It's all about the conversation. Mm-hmm. I love the conversation around the table.
There would be great conversation out of that table.
Well, I did have a dinner party with David McCullough.
Yeah.
The great writer who wrote a lot of, he wrote about Washington and the American Revolution. He's a great historian. I got him to come to dinner once, his wife. I don't know how. I seated him next to Gordon Hammersley's wife. Gordon is a well-known chef.
Chef in Boston. Hammersley's Bistro.
Fiona's English, and she's extremely liberal. And I knew he wasn't. And I sat them together, and they pretty much went after each other for quite a while. And that was one of my.
And you loved that.
I love
getting back to the Kimball family table.
I loved. She kept trashing certain presidents at the time, and he finally allowed us. He was a personal friend of the family, and maybe she should stop doing that. And it was
that's funny.
It was wonderful.
So, and this answer may be different since you started Milk Street and thinking about food in a different way. What do you cook when there's not much in the house to work with?
There's a few things. There's Midnight Noodles, which comes from Fuchsia Dunlop, which is you can use soba or anything. You can use anything. And it's a very simple soy sauce, water, toasted sesame oil, scallions, ginger. That's very simple to do. I would put something very rice. I have this wonderful Japanese rice pot I cook rice in, and just put stuff on rice. I find you can make
so stuff on rice. That's a very technical
stuff
term.
On
I,
rice. Well, I appreciate do that. Do a yellow lentil curry. Doesn't take too long to throw together. We have it in the new issue, and I throw that on rice. So some simple vegetarian dish you can throw together very quickly. Frittata is the ultimate go-to. I always have eggs, and whatever you have in the refrigerator
can go into a frittata.
Yeah,
just don't put blueberries, please.
No, actually, I did the Splendid Table Show. I used to do a fair amount once a year, and we do that. She do that call in where the person would say, "I have blueberries and foie gras." Right. She always managed. Lynn managed to figure out an answer to that. But when the blueberries came up, I said, "Oh no, that's please."
That's a berry du far.
Yeah.
So it's just been declared Chris Kimball Day all over the world. What's happening? What's happening on Chris Kimball Day?
The rioting in the streets. Bread riots,
in Russia in 1917. Bread riots.
I think all the restaurants would be closed.
Okay.
I think people would be forced. It would be Thanksgiving. People would be forced. That's probably too bad a term. People would be enjoined or suggested that they spend the day cooking. And they do it with friends and family. And they don't go out. And they stay home. And they just cook. And that's why... we can argue about the menu of Thanksgiving, although I happen to love it. That's why I love Thanksgiving, because everyone actually cooks. And it's odd to me that since we all do that on Thanksgiving, except Calvin Trillin, that goes out for Chinese food.
Right.
But
or spaghetti carbonara. He has spaghetti carbonara.
Okay, he's become more liberal.
Because he says the Indians have really were serving spaghetti carbonara.
That would be Calvin. He's probably having his car because he's not moving. He's not going out. It's interesting to me that everyone talks so warmly about that experience, Thanksgiving, and yet the day after, everyone's shopping and they've pretty much forgotten about it.
Especially now.
It comes and goes, and it's like, well, wait a minute. What you were so this whole thing about the family and the table, what happened to that?
That's so great, though. The idea that on Chris Kimball Day it's really just Thanksgiving that's a wonderful metaphor.
Well— Yeah, and it doesn't, the great thing, the revelation is it can be something really simple. It doesn't have to be complicated. When I started cooking in the 70s, everything was complicated. We were all doing these, I prep Friday night and cook all day, Saturday have a dinner party and have five courses, make the bouillabaisse and everything else. But no, it can be the simplest thing in the world. You can make some hummus,
Right.
And make some flatbread in a skillet or something. Or make a little spice meat to go on top of it.
Because it's the feeling. It's the gathering around a table and cooking that's much more important than...
Yes. And I think that taking the time... look, how many things can you do today where you can make something by hand? That's why I think cooking's not going away. You can't fix your car anymore.
No
one knows how to fix their plumbing, electrical, or do sheetrock, but you can cook, and so you can do something for other people with your hands, and you get immediate gratification. You get immediate feedback. There are not many things in life that fit that category, right?
Yeah. No, it's true. So I realize I haven't given you an opportunity to talk about the book and give me a succinct description and three favorite recipes.
Oh, boy. You have to make sure I actually read the book.
Yeah, exactly, because I did. If I read it, you have to have read it.
Absolutely.
Because your name's on it. My name's not on it. Doesn't say by Chris Kimball and Ed Levine.
For $5, we can put your name
on it.
Okay,
now the second edition. Naming rights is only $5?
It's a startup, Ed.
Oh, all right.
What was the question again? With three recipes?
Yeah, so three recipes, okay. And just sort of give people a sense of the we obviously talked about the philosophy of Milk Street, which I assume is what they'll find in the book. But is there anything else you want to say about the book?
Yeah, the book is a way of changing your cooking because the recipes aren't hard. For the most part, they're no hard-to-find ingredients. A few recipes, a little more difficult maybe, but most of them not. And the concept is that a recipe should end up having distinct flavors and textures as opposed to the kind of cooking I grew up with. So when you take that first bite, you can taste the coriander and you can taste the cinnamon or you can taste the cilantro. You can taste all these things and they're still there and present when you eat the food. And so on the fifth bite, you still have something interesting going on in your mouth. And it's about developing that contrast and a foundation. It's like music. There's a foundation, a counterpoint, and there's a melody. We can get into all of that. But the point is it's an interesting, it's a complex, the recipe's simple, but the taste is kind of complex. And that's not something I grew up with. And I hope that this book, when you make a few of the recipes, you go, oh, okay. I mean, it's a very different way of thinking about food and what food is and how to cook. And you know, will that succeed in every recipe? No. But that's been the goal. So I would say that there's a few things in there that I think are really terrific. I think the first is the lamb or beef stew. And the point is you have just about a pound of meat. You essentially make a soup with it. You have lots of herbs in it and spices. And it points out the notion that you can have that you don't need stock. I don't use stock anymore. I use water. Guess what? When you cook meat or poultry in water, you make stock. So you just use water. And there's some potatoes and some spices. So you have spices, you have herbs, you have a little meat, you have these things, and it's very simple. And at the end of it, you have a lot of complexity. And I think that's really terrific. The second one, which is the simplest recipe book, is the scrambled eggs, which is
actually olive oil.
Yeah, and you know, the point is olive oil gets hot, butter doesn't because it's got water, right? So you get to 380, 400 degrees, you get the oil almost smoking hot, you put the eggs in, and it just puffs right up. And it takes 15, 20 seconds to cook. And you get a totally different product than you would in butter. And so, you know, it's a simple thing. It's got two eggs, salt, and some olive oil. But the Basque, I opened a Basque cookbook a year ago and found exactly the same recipe. And this just shows you that just changing one ingredient can make all the difference in the world. And I would say the other one that was really like guacamole is, you know, we were with Diana Kennedy and
famous Mexican cooking instructor and chef and cookbook writer.
Yes. Wonderful personality. And she, you know, no garlic, no lime juice. And it's just how you treat the ingredients and how you get the flavor. And it's very simply done. And it's about simplicity. And you let the flavor, obviously, of the avocado come out. And you don't drown it with other things. And you use onion and some other things to get sharp flavor. So there's simplicity in all of that. A little complexity with a soup or the stew, a very simple point about the scrambled eggs, and then in between you have guacamole, which is very simple to do, but it's you just pay attention to the specifics. And that's a more authentic way, by the way, in Central Mexico of making it.
Right.
So it does go back.
That could be your last supper.
It could be.
Yeah.
Yes.
So thank you so much, Chris,
pleasure,
for sharing your special sauce with us. Check out Milk Street, the new home cooking. And, of course, check out Chris's new venture in its many forms, magazine, TV, radio, website, soon-to-be-online store. Thanks, Chris, and we'll see you next time, Serious Eaters.
My pleasure.